Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What made you want to come out to the show tonight?
Definitely seeing Bassem Youssef's interviews, especially with Piers Morgan, that really brought light to how awesome he is and made me want to come and see him in person.
He really put his heart out there, like, for what millions of people are actually expressing, and I wanted to really go see him in person.
We have been supporting Bassem for a couple of years, and we're just here to kind of support Arab Americans who are trying to make imposter change within America.
I feel like he's a good person to represent the Arab community and to represent the situation that's going on.
It's so nice that we can do large events where we're speaking the truth, and it's capturing a lot of views, and I'm just so proud to be a part of it. I appreciate that he's using his voice for the people who don't have a voice right now, or even who have a voice but no one's listening to them.
A voice to the voiceless, he's representing us.
He's basically giving us a voice.
Yeah.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. Welcome to the show. We connected with the people you just heard while they were waiting online to see Egyptian-American comedian Bassem Youssef take the stage in Detroit. And as you heard, a lot of people have been coming to his shows because they feel like he's given them a voice. But that is a complicated idea for Bassem Youssef himself. First off, you got to understand his own story, which is fascinating and remarkable. In Egypt, he hosted a television show of political satire that made him a mega star throughout the entire Middle East. That stardom, born from his relentless critique of the Egyptian government, also made him a target. He was forced to flee the country to avoid becoming a political prisoner. He landed in the U.S., and he began the work of totally rebuilding his life and his craft as a satirist. 10 years later, he has finally found a new artistic voice, and last fall, he launched his first tour as a stand-up comic. And then, October 7th happened. About a month later, Bassem Youssef did an interview with Piers Morgan.
Well, joining me now to discuss the conflict in Israel and Gaza is a TV host and satirist, Bassem Youssef.
In it, he offered a darkly satirical commentary on how easily the world had accepted the mass loss of Palestinian lives during Israel's retaliatory invasion of Gaza.
But, you know, we're used to that. We're used to them being bombed every time and moving from one place to the other. Palestinians, they're very dramatic. Ah, Israel killing us. But they never die. I mean, they always come back. You know, they're very difficult to kill, very difficult people to kill. I know, because I'm married to one. Mm. I tried many times, couldn't kill her.
Like I said, it was kind of dark.
I mean, there's a dark humor there, and I understand why, because...
Oh, it's not dark humor. I try to get to her every time, but she uses our kids as human shields. I can never take her out.
More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed as a result of Israel's invasion. Bassem says he was simply responding on a personal level to all that death. But in doing so, he gave voice to a sentiment that many, many people felt and struggled to articulate themselves. And as a result, the moment went viral. TikTok just blew up with videos cheering on his wry approach.
I truly believe in Bassem Youssef is a literal genius. I'm watching now the second interview that he did with Piers Morgan.
Bassem Youssef has found the best way to converse with Piers Morgan. Sarcasm.
Watching Piers Morgan there struggle is just wonderful. He does not know.
The reaction was so strong that Piers Morgan actually flew to Bassem Youssef's home in Los Angeles to do a two-hour follow-up interview. But here's the thing. This viral moment it's just a blip in a much longer story for Bassem Youssef. I mean, he was once known as the John Stewart of the Arab world, and that reputation almost cost him his life, which maybe is part of why he's not at all excited to have become a new spokesperson for anything. So I sat down with him recently to talk about his journey and about the comedic voice he's actually trying to develop right now, one in which he reflects on his personal experience navigating many overlapping and conflicting cultures. First off, congrats on the tour. You having fun?
I'm having a great time. It's such a pleasure to be able to go around and make people laugh and get money out of it.
Right. It's a unique tour in that you are doing both English and Arabic shows. Why'd you decide to do two languages?
There's always a demand for people in the Arab world that they want to have some Arabic content. And people are kind of reminiscent about my show in Egypt. So I kind of created a new product that's always been a year and a half old to cater for that. And it was actually, surprisingly, it was much more difficult to come up with the Arabic show than the English show.
Because oh, really?
The Arabic show will always be compared with my show back in Egypt. And I didn't want it to be my show in Egypt. And also the Arabic people that come to my show, they expect something that it's not there because they don't know what to expect. Is it going to be me talking about how I talk about stuff in Egypt? Is it about what's happening right now? But it's a personal story. And also I deal with 22 different dialects, a Moroccan dialect, an Algerian dialect, Tunisian dialect. And these dialects are vastly different from the Egyptian dialect. Mm. And this is why to have people from 22 different dialects coming to the same show and follow the same hour, it is very difficult. believe it or not, English is a more of a unifying language.
Wow. Just so I'm clear, do you really try to somehow bridge all 22 dialects in the course of the show?
Oh, yeah, I do. I bring in everybody who comes to the show, find themselves represented somehow. And I would formulate certain sentences that have different words from different dialects, from different cultures. And it sounds extremely funny because one thing in one dialect means a totally different thing. And I'll give you a very stupid example.
Please.
An iron that we iron your clothes with.
Uh-huh.
The same word in Saudi dialect means ass. to look in all kinds of dialects, to look. In Tunisian, it means I farted. It is very difficult and it's very funny. And to formulate that kind of jokes around it, it's challenging, but it could be rewarding if
that's
it's done
really
well.
Cool. So there's a lot of wordplay in the Arabic show that we're missing.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of wordplay. It's a lot of also more crowd work in the Arabic show.
So two of our own producers are big fans and attended separate shows of yours, expecting that you might deal with the politics around what's happening in Gaza, given, the interviews. Of course, you wrote that show before the invasion, but did you ever consider changing it to include Gaza?
This is, again, the problem that people don't understand about comedy. To come up with an hour is very difficult.
Right.
And to have an hour that is set on a tour, comedians work years for it. And I've been only doing stand-up comedy for 4 or 5 years and only came to terms with my 1 hour just a couple of years ago. And I don't want my hour to be topical or to be something that's dealing with the current events. I think this is still evolving. And my 1 hour is my origin story. It still have a lot of politics in it. And it's at the end of the day, it's talking about expression and freedom of expression, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't feel obliged that I have to bring in jokes of what is happening right now. I am doing my show. And I tell people, if you expect that you want to come and see what's something related to the thing, I don't feel comfortable doing it. I would rather harness my craft and work on my hour other than just chasing topical jokes, which is not necessarily what stand-up comedy is. Okay. Stand-up comedy could be that, but also it could be more about telling my own story.
A lot of people have been newly introduced to you and your work because of the interview you did with Piers Morgan. You were obviously very popular before that. But for a number of folks, that is how they've become introduced to you. And so you've got a lot of these new eyes and ears parsing your words. What has that been like? And have you gained new audiences you weren't expecting?
Yes. So there's a lot of people who were not aware of me before that interview. And when they come to the show, I want them to know me, who I am. And I think like my stand-up comedy hour right now, it's relatable to a lot of people who might be immigrants from other countries or even living in this country and feel that they are like under pressure to perform through different expectations. And that my show is about that. So it is actually more relatable to people more than it is than you're just talking about a certain event. I talk deeper about my own experience as an immigrant, as someone who always found himself as a fish out of water, like being in comedy while not belonging to it, being in America while not being exactly welcomed under certain administration. So it is it's an ongoing story that people can relate to, not just something that's at point of time.
As part of Bassem's show, he asked the audience, you know, like who they are. He's trying to get a demographic makeup of his audience. And he says it has changed since the Piers Morgan interview.
I'm having more South Asian people coming, Indian, Pakistani, Afghani. They're increasing in my day, even like sometimes even more than Arabs, which is very interesting. A lot of Middle East, Turkish, Persian, a lot come to my show. African and Latin Americans also come to my show. And I joke about this, like it seems like I'm the brown hero in the face of the white imperialism. Yeah, the demography of the people coming to the show has kind of shifted.
And why do you think that shift happened? What is driving that?
I think a lot of people relate to the problem of Palestine as their own problem because they see how the West has kind of impose their own narrative and all rules forever. And now they see someone who speaks against them in the same language and refuting their calls. Because the problem with Palestine is the problem of Indians with British, the problem with Pakistani with the British, the problem with maybe anybody with the British. And the kind of like the idea of like being put down because of your ethnicity and your background has been very disheartening.
You've said that part of the reason you have spoken up quite vocally in that Piers Morgan interview and elsewhere is that partly is that you're speaking up for your wife and her family who are from Gaza. By the way, where are they now? Is everyone safe in her family?
No, they are in Rafah waiting to be to have a bomb dropped on their heads like everybody else. So hope they're going to be safe.
How has that been for your family trying to...
Well, despite what people might think, we are carrying on with our life as normal because we have been living with this for years. It's been kind of like in the background of our life. It's kind of white noise. And you cannot think about it 24/7 because you need to survive at the end of the day. It's very difficult. But like when I get the chance to talk about it, I try to represent that case as much as I can. And I find it extending way beyond the Gaza, way beyond Palestinians. And I'm kind of my identity as an Arab, as a Muslim is being questioned. Because when you see Palestinian flags or pro-Palestinian thing, and they're called terrorists, so I could be called a terrorist tomorrow. Mm. If I speak against Israel, I'm an anti-Semite. If I speak against the American policy, I'm a terrorist. So where does it end? Mm. Same way, basically, what happened to me in Egypt, I was just like doing comedy, and then I'm being accused of a secret Freemason and a secret Jew and an infidel and a CIA agent, all of that kind of thing. So I find it kind of a deja vu happening all over again.
This is Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. More of my conversation with Egyptian-American comedian Bassem Youssef is just ahead. How he became known as the John Stewart of Egypt and how he had to flee for his life as a result. Stay with us.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. And a special welcome to our new listeners at WHYY in Philadelphia, WYPR in Baltimore, and on South Carolina Public Radio. Great to have all of you in the community. I'm talking this week with Egyptian-American comedian Bassem Youssef about his life and career, first as a megastar political satirist in Egypt and across the Arab world, and now as an immigrant building a new life and finding a new artistic voice in the United States. For more than a decade, he's been known here in the U.S. as the John Stewart of Egypt. But back in Egypt, Bassem started off in a career that's about as far away from comedy as I can imagine. He was a heart surgeon. I asked him why he chose that work initially.
Well, I mean, you do that because that's what's expected of you in the Middle East. I say it in my comedy, it's like you're either expected to be a doctor or an engineer or a disappointment. And I went through the motions of it because that is like kind of a clear path of a career, but I never liked it. Mm. So when the revolution happened and the Arab Spring happened, I did these YouTube videos and then I find a way, oh, I can live my life differently. So it was not like a spur of a moment. It was not like an overnight shift. It was kind of like calculated risk.
Yeah. And this was just before the Egyptian revolution. And you got interested in making a YouTube series. And this was while you were waiting on a visa to come to the U.S. and work as a doctor in Cleveland, actually. What was the original content of that show? What were you making?
Well, when the 2011 revolution happened, the Arab Spring happened, there was all kinds of like misinformation and lies. So I kind of got inspired to do it like a Jon Stewart Daily Show style. And I started to cut some of their ridiculous statement that we saw on television and their ridiculous claims, and I started commenting on it, and it was kind of like a 5 minute, 6 minute, 7 minutes video, and it went viral. And after 6-7 episodes, I was offered my own television show.
Okay. At the height of it, it was the most watched show in the region, around 30 million viewers a week.
Yeah, in only in Egypt. The rest of the region was like hundreds of millions. Yeah.
Do you remember what that feeling was like? Sort of the first time you looked up and thought, oh, wow, people recognize me on the streets for this stuff.
It was always something that blew my mind away, but also put me under a lot of pressure that I was scared about the expectations. And there's always this feeling that you're not deserving to be in that position. That at the beginning, I remember like I didn't like people taking pictures of me because like that's too much. That's kind of infatuation. That's not real. And this is what fame or exposure to fame, especially if it was sudden and that so big, it does to you. It would either humble you or go to your head because it's very toxic. So it was something that I rejected from the get-go. I'm someone who's worked as a doctor, either a medical student or a medical doctor for 19 years. So I'm not used to that kind of admiration and adoration. Actually, it's the complete opposite. As a resident, you're being put down by your professors, and it's more of a military kind of lifestyle. And you don't have that kind of like sense of self-worth. You always feel that you are always underperforming or not deserving, basically. So I had to struggle with that because it didn't come easy to kind of accept that kind of fame.
What do you think you had touched at that time that so quickly made people drawn to your work? What do you think it was that you were touching for them emotionally?
The idea of political satire, kind of like straightforward political satire, was not there. It is kind of like indirect satire. But like when they were in a position where we can call out what's happening in real time, that was something that people were not used to. So people found something that was missing and related to.
When Bassem launched his TV show, it was a moment when free press in Egypt didn't really exist. There had been a dictator for 30 years, and the average person just didn't really feel they had representation on the national stage. That's even what attracted some of the show's writers to join him in the effort. Many of them started off as fans of the show. Here's what one of them said in a 2016 documentary about Bassem called Tickling Giants.
I remember the first time I saw Bassem Youssef's show. I saw it as something on my side. He was encouraging people to be more critical toward authority. It's someone who's saying things that are similar to what we're saying to each other. Things that are not usually on TV. Things that are critical of the media and the way it controls the people's minds. He's like our guy.
Bassem, it was a moment of catharsis for a lot of people, I imagine, to watch your show. Was it cathartic for you to do the show?
It was always a source of pressure. Never cathartic. There's always the pressure to do a good show, a good episode. And if you did a really good episode, you think about how can I top it the next week. So I was always been in a position where I enjoyed it. This is one of the things that I regret doing the show, that I didn't actually, I was not in a position to enjoy myself.
Oh.
I was more under the pressure to perform and to do the best every time. It was very relentless.
You are very hard on yourself, it sounds like.
Well, anybody in the field of that much exposure, I don't think they are completely satisfied with what they offered, and they always think that they are underperforming. And I think that's like a huge part of the creative or the artistic life. Mm-hmm. This is why you find a lot of them in either have suicidal thoughts or depression, because they always think that we are not going good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you reach a new high, you're afraid that you cannot top that, and it's a vicious circle, and it's very difficult to deal with that kind of life and expectations.
Have you been able to get past that? Do you still feel that way?
I'm trying to. I'm trying to find a place in my life where I'm more appreciative and more grateful for what I have, instead of trying to strive what I should be doing or what I can do more, because it's an endless loop, and it eats you up.
It will surely eat you up. It will surely eat you up. The show started to gain the attention of not just fans, but the regime. You had at least two Egyptian presidents file legal claims against you.
Hundreds of supporters of Bassem Youssef have protested the arrest of the popular television presenter.
And then you were eventually brought in to be interrogated by the authorities.
Bassem Youssef was cracking jokes via Twitter, even when he was in the prosecutor's office. And it's that.
But I understand you didn't really take it seriously at first.
Yeah, I felt that it was ridiculous. And now it's actually part of my stand-up comedy show, part of that interrogation scene. It's part of my show. And I don't know why. I was always kind of like in denial that something bad would happen to me, even when I was, I don't know, maybe this is that feeling of like surviving that was going on in the background, that like if everything is going to be okay, although like nothing seems to be okay.
Well, it's funny, I guess it's, you know, you can normalize anything emotionally, it seems like, you know,
yeah.
Like as humans, we
yeah.
can.
Yeah, I think it's a defense mechanism, I guess.
There was a moment in your journey, you say that not only did the state come after you, but your friends and some members of your family started to believe some of the things that were being printed about you, that you were an operative or that you had actually been recruited by John Stewart to destabilize the Egyptian state.
Yeah, I had people from my friends and family who kind of believed that. They believed, mostly they were the pro-military people who kind of liked me a lot when I was like doing the show against the Muslim Brotherhood, and then kind of like turned against me when I did it against the army. And I saw the tide shift very, very quickly, and it was disheartening to see it in real time. And it's people that they know me, they worked with me, they went to school with me, they have been around me and know who I am. And then to find them like kind of like turn that way, it just, you feel like, it's like if you don't know who I am or don't understand where I come from, who will? And there, and I have to admit that I was more reactive to what people think about me. Now I'm less and less kind of not letting that affect me. I'm trying to find a way where I don't get affected by what people's thoughts about me or how. And maybe it's a general theme of like not seeking people's validation. And I think it's we as humans, we do that a lot. And I think it's a problem that we need to get rid of.
I wonder if the experience, though, also is part of your skepticism of fame and notoriety.
Yeah, because I always think that I'm not deserving that to be in that position. So it's very different. It's a part of me is like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be even here in this first place.
How did all of this escalate to the point where you decided you needed to leave Egypt?
Well, at a certain point, there was like lawsuits against me. And in places like Egypt, when you get a lawsuit, it is meant to actually put you in jail eventually, even if it always took some time. Because in order to preserve their image in the world, they have to find a way that legally to kind of like cripple you. But my lawyer said, like, you need to leave right away.
Oh, wow.
You need to leave right away because, there was a verdict against me at 12 noon. At 5 o'clock, I was on a plane leaving Egypt.
Wow. That was the moment of connecting with reality, I guess.
Yes.
These confusing political times have come back to bite Bassem. His show has shut down due to what he calls, quote, insurmountable pressure. Now, between lectures at Harvard...
Even before Bassem Youssef started his show in Egypt, he had admired Jon Stewart. And in many ways, he modeled his own platform after The Daily Show. So when the show got hugely popular, comparisons between the two satirists grew. And when Jon Stewart noticed that comparison, he reached out. He had Bassem on his show a few times.
Please welcome Bassem Youssef.
And when Bassem moved to the U.S., that relationship became even stronger.
We're not very much different.
No.
Can I ask a question?
It was actually one of Jon Stewart's producers who made that 2016 documentary called Tickling Giants. But once here in the U.S., Bassem decided he wanted to try something new. So you came to the U.S. And you switched platforms for your work from this show to stand-up comedy. Why did you switch to stand-up comedy? What was it about stand-up comedy that drew you?
I didn't switch to stand-up comedy right away. There was a period where I was kind of lost. I didn't find myself in the United States. I started giving like speeches and lectures about my journey. And, you know, people find it interesting, a doctor turned comedian and then getting against the authority. And it was a good story, but I couldn't stay that story forever. I couldn't just like speak about my life forever in this kind of form because it became repetitive and I wanted to do something that is more interesting and more exciting. So I turned this first into like a one-man show. And then from the one-man show, I would turn it into more of a performance.
One of those performances was a 2016 satirical video series called Democracy Handbook, where Bassem tried to learn more about the political system of his new home here through the lens of a Muslim immigrant.
Having just arrived in the U.S., I'm so grateful that the mainstream media provides so many tips for how Muslims can fit in here.
We need the help of every Muslim who would like to be accepted as an American to isolate and identify the terrorists.
I want to be accepted. I'll turn in anyone, even my brother. But no, where should I start?
They are really concerned.
And then that performance slightly veered into the stand-up comedy. So it actually happened over the years. And then maybe 3-4 years ago, and then I said, oh, maybe what I'm doing is stand-up comedy. So now I said, like, well, I guess I'm going to call myself a comedian now because I didn't call myself a comedian before.
You didn't? You didn't consider it comedy before?
No, I would call myself a satirist or a one-man show, doing a long show or a speaker. But, like, I didn't say that I'm a comedian or a stand-up comedian because I feel that I wasn't earning it.
We asked our listeners for questions for you in advance of the show. And here's one voicemail we got from Hisham in Houston.
You're speaking differently when you do a show in Arabic and shows in English. Are you trying to get different things across to these groups? What are you hoping each group will take away from hearing you speak?
No, the English show is different from the Arabic show. The Arabic show, because I'm dealing with different dialects, so I have to put that in consideration. I'm the only comedian that people come from all over the world, to Arab world, to see him. If I'm a Lebanese comedian, or most Lebanese and Syrian will come and see them. If I'm a Saudi, Saudis will, the Moroccan, Moroccans will only come and see it. Moroccan, Tunisian and Algerian have kind of their own dialect. So when I started doing the show, it was difficult to kind of, how can I cater to all of those people? So I had to find a way where I can like unify those people in a way and also tell them a unifying story, which will have to be a personal story. Political satire might not work because what do I do? Do I make fun of politics in Egypt? But it would work for someone in Morocco. Or like, I had to find a theme that is unifying for everybody. So the theme that was unifying were, how interesting it is that we have all different dialects. What is the expectation of you coming to the show? And now my own personal story as a doctor and related to two people. My English stand-up comedy is my work as a doctor leaving Egypt, coming here under Donald Trump as a president. And this is basically an immigrant experience. So both of them are different and they cater differently for different audiences. And it is not like something about the message as much as like, how can I make this entertaining and also thoughtful for the people who come to the show? So the English show about being like the idea of like not belonging and being to be living through other people's expectation. Well, the Arabic show is how vastly different as we are, while we think we are very similar as Arabs, but we're not. Mm. So it just had different themes. And I had people coming to the English show and the Arabic show 2 days in a row, and they have a totally vastly different experiences, different feelings about it.
Well, and it's also, we should say, I mean, you know, English is a second language for you. You had to learn your trade and learn your art in this new language. What was that like?
Very difficult at the beginning, because you can write a perfect joke, but you don't deliver it well, because it has to be delivered according to the rules of that language. Because each language has its cadence, and that's rhythm and timing. And the timing in each language is different. So I had to kind of like learn it by like trial and error. There was no manual for me other than just like watching other comedians. But there is no really manual. There's no one really teaches you who does that. I mean, the only advice you can get from other comedians is slow down, which I have to work on it. And it works, basically.
I'm Kai Wright. I'm talking with Egyptian-American comedian Bassem Youssef. His political satire in Egypt captivated tens of millions of fans and forced him to flee to the U.S., where he's been finding a new voice, and where he's also finding new fans who once again feel that his political voice on Gaza represents them, regardless of whether that's his intent. We caught up with a few of them outside of a recent show in Detroit.
I got to know Bassem Youssef thanks to John Stewart years ago. And like, wow, what, you know, like fresh air.
We have been supporting Bassem since really for a couple of years. We've been, you know, watching his interviews and some of his satire.
We're Egyptian, he's Egyptian too.
I've been familiar with his work for a long time. You know, as early as when he used to go on Jon Stewart. He's a really funny guy.
I just think he's hilarious. I love his sarcasm. It's very lighthearted regarding really heavy topics, and sometimes you just need that.
We've seen him before. It's good that he makes fun of politics, makes fun of people.
He speaks up for what's going on in the real world and says it how it is.
And he's honest and open about what he thinks and what he feels.
I think that a lot of people can relate to his brand of humor, and he was able to open a door that many other people haven't been able to during interviews.
So intelligent, resonated with the West. He's making us proud.
It's Notes from America. More of my conversation with Bassem Youssef just ahead.
Hi, I'm Regina, a producer here at Notes from America with Kai Wright. I know, you're loving this episode. I promise I won't hold you long. But I have to ask, have you seen what we're up to on Instagram? That's where we post questions to you that help shape the conversations that we have on this podcast. Plus, it's a great way to keep up with the show. Follow Notes with Kai on Instagram. That's at Notes with Kai. And we'll talk to you there. Thanks for listening.
Oh!
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. I'm talking this week with Egyptian-American comedian Bassem Youssef about his journey from superstardom as a political satirist in the Middle East to developing a new voice as a stand-up comic in the United States. Bassem, you have started a children's book series, by the way, called The Magical Reality of Nadia, which is named after your daughter. It's a personal story about her real-life experiences as an immigrant that faces the difficulties that come with, you know, being an immigrant in the United States, like new friends and racism. How has it been not only relocating yourself here, but doing that with a young daughter, too?
Relocating the United States has been, of course, it has some challenges, but like eventually it's been working out very well for us. We live in a good district with a good school system. And she enjoys going to school and has, I think we, one of the things that I appreciate about living in the States, especially living in Los Angeles and California, how this diverse her school is and how you have people from all different kinds of backgrounds, from Latin America and people even from Europe and Africa and Asia. And they're just like, it's beautiful that like your kids know that the rule is being different, not the exception. And I think it opens up her horizon and her minds about the world that we live in. So, and I'm very appreciative of that.
Another question from a listener that's related to this asks, how have you integrated with the American community to feel like you belong and feel American without losing your identity? It's a question I ask myself every day.
I didn't have a problem with that, actually, to be honest. It's not something I struggled with. What I struggled with is finding my place in the society to be a productive member of society, to have my own career. And that's something that even Americans deal with. I mean, there are stand-up comedians who have been white and Americans and born here, and they struggle with. So I think my biggest struggle was like a real struggle and finding my way to reinvent myself here. But I never felt that like I'm an outsider or something to have to blend in. I mean, the American society gives you the chance to be yourself and at the same time to be American. And it doesn't have to be something that is opposing. I love being in the United States. I love the opportunities the United States have given me. And I'm very happy to be an American Egyptian. So it's not something that I have struggled with. I mean, if there's anything that I've struggled with, it's like struggling with the political narrative of how America has been supporting Israel with no question asked. This is something that I've been struggling with. Maybe it is something that I've been talking about right now. But on a personal level, on a day-to-day basis, I haven't had any problem blending into that American society at all.
Yeah. Well, on the political level, I mean, you of course, you have tons of experience doing satire or comedy in the face of difficult times. But does this moment in Gaza feel different? I mean, the level of destruction and death is just so intense. When you think about trying to engage it as satire or as comedy, does it feel different or harder than it did in the past?
Yes, because like you see all of this destruction and all of this civilian death and people just like gaslight you, making you accept that it is just like a necessity. It's something that we have to do, and we're sorry about the people being killed on the long way, but like you have to endure it until I don't know what it is. Is it like just killing the terrorists, killing Hamas, or just like getting everybody out of the region? It's just like the level of gaslighting and denial of like what this is has been astounding and very, very distressing. And the fact that like then you really discover that like we're not equal, and people look at people from my part of the world are not equal, the same way that like black people were treated as less, and how they would go in and they enslave and torture black people, and then when one black person stands up and retaliate, his whole family, his whole community, his whole village could be burned to the ground. Which means that like we are not equal. And our lives and our blood is not equal and is not treated equally. So all of these empty words about equality and how we are all the same is not, it's really ridiculous.
On our show, we've been following the journey of Hisham Arwatani, the college student who was shot in Burlington, Vermont in November of last year. And he's another person who has become a bit of a reluctant icon. You reached out to him as well. What made you do that?
My manager called me and he said, like, there's this group of family that wanted to attend the show, but they are in the hospital and they cannot leave. And they're wondering if you would visit them. So I said, I need to go and visit them. And I visited him and I connected him on a personal level. He's such a bright kid.
Yeah.
And then I was very sad that we tried to bring him, we tried to talk to his doctor, but like he wouldn't allow him to be committed to a wheelchair because he was just wearing a kufi and speaking Arabic and someone shoots him. It's terrible. Wow.
You ended up having him FaceTime into your show in Boston.
Yes, 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 I did that.
Why did you decide to do that and what was it like?
Well, since we can't get him physically, so at least we will get him in spirit. And people just like responded, they love that very much. Yeah.
Maybe it's a Palestinian thing. What'd you have him talk about?
Well, I told him, like, he's your family, he's your friends, and we talked to them, and I promised him when he gets better that I would fly him anywhere to come and attend the show.
Well, as someone who, again, has a similar experience, well, the part of being a reluctant icon, Hisham talked to us about that as well, being put on a pedestal, and that's not what he was looking for. What advice would you give someone like him for navigating that kind of moment?
Be yourself and don't be pressured by other people wanting you to be something else. Because if you follow people, it's a bottomless pit. You'll never be able to satisfy them and you'll always come up short. Do what makes you feel better about yourself.
I wonder, as we wrap up, what you do to take care of yourself? Because I do wonder about how much of, sorry to play your shrink, but how much of your skepticism of fame is the trauma of having lost everything once before?
Yeah, well, I'll try to find refuge with my family, with my kids, with my wife. And it's been always a supportive family. This is a place that we feel safe. And I try not to think too much about what should have been, what would have been, what can be, instead of trying to enjoy what I already have, which is a lot, and I appreciate that I have that. And I think it's kind of like to be grateful instead of being angry and bitter. That helps a lot.
Be grateful instead of angry and bitter. Well, there's a lesson for all of us in everything we do.
Thank you so much.
Bassem Youssef is an Egyptian-American comedian. His stand-up show is called The Middle Beast Tour. Before we wrap up this week, I want to take a minute to talk about probably my favorite element of our show, which is you. Every week, we ask you to join the conversation and to keep talking to us even after the show ends. So we continue to get responses by email, by voicemail, even on Instagram. And the person managing all of these various inboxes is our producer, Regina Dahir, who joins me now. Hey, Regina.
Hey, Kai. Our inboxes have been filling up with responses to our last few episodes. I would even go as far as to say the episode where you took calls from people whose politics were changed by the ongoing situation in Gaza, that episode got more responses than any episode we've ever done.
That really doesn't surprise me. Our guest for that show was an Arab-American civil rights advocate who helped launch the movement that got more than 100,000 Democratic voters to choose uncommitted rather than Joe Biden in the Michigan primary. And we asked people who consider themselves Democrats in particular, has the war in Gaza impacted the way you plan to vote in November or made your decision harder in any way?
Yes, and we got answers from all across the board. For example, we got a direct message on Instagram from Izzat, who is a Jewish listener living in Brooklyn, New York. The listener shares that they have two little kids who they want to raise with strong Jewish values, but they feel like those values are threatened in the current political culture. They feel like Jewish people, like themselves, have been, quote, abandoned by both parties.
Yeah, so political homelessness, it was certainly a theme of the night. Where else did people go?
Well, another person who chimed in on Instagram is Joyati, who echoed something we heard a lot in the show itself, which is that, as they put it, quote, Biden needs to hear us and earn our vote.
Yeah, this was a common theme in the live show, earn our vote. A lot of people who probably would be supporting Joe Biden and just say he has not done that because of Gaza.
Yeah, so they are certainly not alone. But also, we got a lot of messages from people who wanted to challenge the premise of the conversation. Here's a few voicemails to give you an idea.
This is Sylvie from Minnesota, and I've been listening to the show. I'm curious what these people who are not going to vote for Biden, what they think Trump is going to do better for the Palestinians.
Hi, Notes from America. Hey, I totally get it. I am definitely a Democrat, and I think what Israel is doing to Palestine as a reaction to this Hamas massacre is horrifically terrible. But the thing that your show is missing is just saying, and I think you as the moderator, Kai, you need to say this, not voting for Biden in this election may give the presidency to Trump and, you know, for America, oh my God, what are we going to go back to the 1950s? We already lost, you know, with his Supreme Court idiot picks. We lost an abortion and we'll probably lose our democracy.
Hi, my name is Liz, and I'm calling from Minneapolis. It was very interesting to me the way the show put itself across as people are losing faith in Biden. They're doubting whether they should vote for Biden. And the person who had actually started the campaign for voting undecided, and she was very, very clear that it was to get a message across for the primaries, and in no way were they trying to affect the voting in November. I guess I am concerned about how the media is portraying this movement, that it's casting doubt on the November elections, whereas it isn't that at all. And I think it's a little irresponsible of the media to be portraying it in this way, unwittingly or willingly. Thank you.
Yeah, Liz, I hear you. We did try to be really clear about the uncommitted movement. And our guest, Rima Merue, who are focused only on the primary, not the general. But for many, many people, including many of our callers, it is more than that. So we wanted to make space for them too. And also, listen, I get it. Given January 6th and given Trump's ongoing refusal to accept the results of the last election, a wide range of people across the ideological spectrum are just really, really anxious about anything that distracts from simply directly challenging his path to power. But also, this is the democracy we say we want to defend, and it's a messy business with a lot of perspectives. So we hope our role will not be parsing votes one way or the other, but facilitating real, actual conversations about all the different gray area between the partisan organizations, which is where I think most people probably sit in this complicated American experiment. So we're going to keep trying, and we thank all of you for trying with us.
And to that end, our next conversation about that messy democracy stuff, Kai, is on yet another controversial topic. Mm-hmm. We're going to wade into the debate about whether there's a movement of Black people supporting former President Donald Trump.
Okay, yeah, so this will be interesting. It's going to be Sunday, April 7th, in partnership with our friends at the show Today Explained, which is co-hosted by journalist Noelle King. And Noelle and I have been reading a lot and talking a lot about what Black voters in general are thinking in 2024. So there was a New York Times and Siena College poll that found 23% of Black voters said they would vote for Donald Trump if the election were held at that moment. So is this true? And if it is true, what's going on in the Black community? 23% is significantly more support than Trump got from Black voters in the past. So why this sharp change? We're going to explore that this coming Sunday on April 7th, and we will take all of your calls on the topic.
Well, actually, you can start calling as soon as you're finished listening to this show. If you're a Black person who is newly considering Donald Trump, or if this is a conversation already happening in your social circle, leave us a voicemail at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. Or leave us a message on our socials at Notes with Kai. I'll keep an eye out. But Kai, before we go, we did get stuff that wasn't just about the election.
Okay.
A lot of the time, we get comments on the reels you make.
Oh, on my Instagram reels.
Yeah, your Instagram reels. Like after seeing you post in your weekend clothes about that episode we did with David Alan Greer, user at Harlem Twal Girl asks, can we also talk about the wallpaper?
Oh, well, yes, we can. In fact, so Harlem Twal Girl is Sheila Bridges. Shout out Sheila Bridges for hanging out on our Instagram. Sheila Bridges is a world famous designer who designed the wallpaper in my house. I mean, she didn't design it for me. She designed it for the world and I bought some that has a really cool backstory about Black history and reclaiming racist narratives in the way that Black people often do in art. And it's fascinating. And maybe we can get Sheila Bridges on the show to tell us that story. Stay tuned.
Well, I definitely look forward to learning more about that. And we also got a lot of responses to our episode we did about intercultural relationships. Kai, you'll remember that for Valentine's Day, we asked you listeners what you learned about yourselves through your intercultural relationships.
Yeah.
But one unexpected response we got was a lot of really sweet love stories.
Aww.
Like we got this one from Dan.
Hi, I am Dan in Wichita, Kansas. I am listening to you on KMUW. I have now been married for 41 years to a woman from the Philippines. I am a white man born in Houston, Texas, grew up in Wichita, Kansas. These 41 years have been immensely happy for me and for her, I'm pleased to say. We have a couple of sons. They have a couple of kids. We obviously have a lot of different cultures going on in our family, and it's fantastic.
Oh, well, Dan, I do hope your wife agrees that those 41 years have indeed been really happy. And congratulations to you both. That is no small feat.
Yeah, that was really cool to hear as someone who's getting married this year myself.
Mm-hmm.
I hope for such a long-lasting marriage.
Well, may you have it, Regina. And thank you for bringing us this wonderful mailbag.
Thank you, Kai. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Notes from America is a production of WNYC Studios. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and keep up with us on Instagram at Notes with Kai. This episode was produced by Suzanne Gabber and Regina Dehier. Mixing and theme music by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Katarina Barton, Matthew Mirando, Siona Petros, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for spending time with us.